Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 1st, 2008, and this is show number 176. And with only, 14 minutes of assistance by the Ustream audience, we were actually able to get the audio working just fine. Finally. Well, I had a great day today. I got to go to my buddy Harry's birthday party. Harry is 90 years old tomorrow. I want to dedicate this show to him because Harry Hampton is the guy, the person we all want to be. He's interesting. He's funny. He loves people. And he asks you questions about your life instead of talking about himself or talking about, come on, you got to have some aches and pains by 90 years old, I'm thinking, right? But Harry's always got a smile. He's a fun guy. He's just really, really nice, and everybody loves him. And it was neat to see. We got to meet his brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews. And what did he have? His daughter, his granddaughter, and his great-granddaughter there. His great-granddaughter's 23 years old, also born on the same day as Harry. So, man, this guy is an inspiration. We should all be as lucky as he is. Well, I believe we may have established at this point in the show that I'm a nerd and a geek and an engineer, right? I am fearless in the face of IP configurations, loading new software. Even a little bit of hardware work doesn't even scare me. But you know what does scare me? Sewing. Well, you see, my friend Gary had this backrest that fit him just perfectly. He bought it like 20 years ago, had this brown corduroy cover on it, but he finally wore through it after about 10 years. Well, as a joke, I went out and I bought some baby blue fabric with Looney Tunes all over it, and I made him a new cover. I had the luxury that time of being able to unsew the old cover and make a pattern out of it. Well, let's fast forward 10 years, and he's worn through my new cover I created him. Well, I just happened to be digging around in a cabinet the other day looking for a toga I made for Kyle many years ago. I don't think I'm this amazing seamstress. Remember, I'm terrified of this. A toga is basically a bed sheet, and I sewed some purple ribbon on the edge, right? Not too complicated. Anyway, I found the original Looney Tunes fabric. I brought it in to show Gary how nice it used to look, and he showed me how bad his new one looks, and he begged me to put a new cover on it. Well, that one was falling apart. It had the foam coming out and everything. So he gave me he has a new cover, a new backrest, and I'm trying to make a cover for that one. But I'm telling you, this is just terrifying me. I'm trying to make a pattern where I'm just looking at something. It's just awful. I'm trying to use my sewing machine. I don't even know how to use my sewing machine. I haven't used it in like 5 years, maybe 10. Unlike listener Lynn, who has this fancy schmancy sewing machine that has programmable things and everything, I have this $100 Brother machine I've probably used 10 times in 25 years. I fired up and it decided that it wants each stitch to be like 1 millimeter long. While being a mechanical engineer, I took it apart as far as I could, stuffed oil in it, and it still doesn't work. I think I'll go back to playing with my computers. Well, last week on Chit Chat Across the Pond, Bart and I were geeking out about what matters to us in a router. One of the things he said was that he likes a router that lets him do static DHCP. Well, that confused me because I thought DHCP meant to have your IP address of your machine dynamically assigned each time you connected, while static, by its very definition, means that it never changes. Bart went on to explain that what he meant was a router would always be in charge of dispensing the IP address dynamically to the machine, so it's not really static, but the router could be set up to always give it the same IP address every time. The subtlety I was missing is that when you set up a static IP, you do that on your computer, not on the router. If you do it on the computer that way, then you go to someone else's house or say to work, it'll try to force that IP onto the network, which may or may not work. So, for example, let's say I give my laptop a static IP of 192.168.1.100. Well, 192.1.168 happens to be the space that Linksys routers use. But then I go to a friend's house who has an Apple router, but Apple uses 10.0.1 for the IPs. I'd be out of luck. So do you see how that clarifies it? If I set the router to give me the same IP address every time, but the router to give the IP address, then I can go ahead and move my laptop to another place to get the IP address there. Anyway, I'm bringing all of this up again because Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast wrote in with some comments about that discussion. Here's what he said. You're right, Allison. Static DHCP is an oxymoron, and it is, in fact, an incorrect term. What Bart is referring to is technically called reservation DHCP, And indeed, not very many routers support it. The Apple ones, Airport, Time Capsule, do, but the Linksys ones don't. Unless you upgrade to the third-party Tomato firmware, which I briefly mentioned in the chat channel last night. It adds reservation DHCP support, as well as QoS, quality of service, which ensures that bandwidth hogs like huge podcast downloads or BitTorrent don't totally choke other people's email, casual web browsing, etc. Live bandwidth monitoring, which is great for Comcast users or anyone who else has to deal with bandwidth caps, or if you're morbidly curious as to how much bandwidth you use, and tons of other features. He said, gave us a link to polarcloud.com/tomato where you're able to download it. Well, thanks for the explanation, Donald. I did mention how fearless I am on geek stuff, but the one thing I'm not fearless on is messing with my perfectly functioning router. If I had two routers, maybe, well, I guess I technically do, but I had maybe a week to experiment and nobody was at home whining at me that they lost their connection, maybe I'd give Tomato a whirl. But for now, I think I'll just dream about such experimentation. But for the rest of you, maybe you want to go check out Tomato at polarcloud.com. So I think I've mentioned a few times that I'm trying to learn Aperture. Yes, James, I am reading the manual, and I bought a book to teach myself, and I'm actually reading it. It's slow going, though, from the philosophy perspective. I've been trying to figure out the best way to organize my photos. You see, Aperture has projects and albums and folders, and I'm trying to figure out why I would use one over the other. Well, enter Debbie T. from splashofstyle.com. She's been a godsend to me on getting all of this figured out. Guess how she's been instructing me? With Screen Steps, of course! She's been making little tutorials for me and posting them on screenstepslive.com. At Screen Steps Live, you can upload lessons to their server so you don't have to host them yourself. And they have a really nice automatic interface that gives you little tabs and just formats everything beautifully. You can see what I mean by checking out the Audacity manual that I keep pretending I'm going to finish over at nosillacast.screenstepslive.com. They have a free version of Screen Steps Live that's good for one person, and then they have a more advanced version at a fee if you're collaborating with other people, or let's say you need to limit access to your Screen Steps lessons, but you want to be able to give out codes for people to get to them. Check out the options at screensteps.live.com/signup. Remember, you get 25% off the purchase of Screen Steps by putting in the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards if you haven't figured it out yet, in all capital letters. Do that when you make your purchase and get 25% off.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Pierre wrote in with a couple of perfect dumb questions all about Apple Mail. His first question goes like this. In the bottom left corner of Apple Mail, I have mail activity. I notice sometimes that the activity bar starts up and indicates that it's downloading messages, but I don't see new messages in my inbox. What gives? Is it downloading messages in my spam folder? Well, I did a little bit of research because I didn't know what the answer was. I found out that you can double-click on the rotating arrows when you see them down in the corner, and the activity window will come up to show you what's going on. You can also access this window by going to Window and pulling down to Activity. I tested it while I was writing an email to Peter, explaining this to him, and it showed a whole bunch of activity going on. For example, it showed I was saving a draft of the email, I was doing some synchronization with Gmail Online as well. It even updated some cache files. Strangely, I didn't actually see the double arrows showing the activity, but a bunch of activity is going on. That does kind of explain why you would see that. Peter had a second question. Here's what he said. Is there an option to save or not save messages as you send them? In order to avoid filling up my outbox with sent messages that I do not want to keep, it'd be nice to have this option. Even Lotus Notes has this feature. Lotus Notes. Oh, well. I looked at the preferences and did not see a preference that would give me this. Well, I have a solution to his second problem, too. And it's not exactly what he asked for, but I think it'll get the job done. In the menu bar, you can choose Mail, then pull down to Preferences. Click on the Accounts tab. Then select the account you want to change in the left sidebar. Over on the right, the third option down is to control how sent mail is saved. It turns out you can choose to save sent mail on the server, but the option below that is to delete sent messages at different times. One of the things you can choose is never, which is the default. You can delete after a day, a week, or a month. Or if you never want to keep them at all, you can set it to delete sent messages every time you quit mail. Now, what he really wanted to do was save some and not others, so I suggested that every time he's about to quit mail, he just moves the one he wants to keep into a separate folder and then he'd be able to keep them. I enjoyed these questions because I didn't know the answers when I started, and it was really fun to figure them out. Perfect dumb questions. I bet other people would wonder as well. Okay, this is a great story, this next one, because all of you are going to benefit because of the results of the letter that I got this week. And it's kind of embarrassing why, but I'm always into self-deprecation, so why not tell the story? Well, you might remember last week I interviewed a guy from a company called Humanware, which makes accessible products for the visually impaired. Completely coincidentally, a visually impaired client of Humanware's asked them for assistance playing my podcast on one of their devices. Evidently, it wouldn't play, and Mark Andre from Humanware had to diagnose the problem. Turns out this device has a data buffer that's responsible for keeping in memory data that's usually often accessed, like, say, the header of the MP3 file. Well, the MP3 decoder was requesting to keep the entire header of my file in memory, but it couldn't because the header file was too big. The header file on my MP3 file was nearly 8 megabytes. Well, he dug in and he discovered that the issue was that my cover art was actually an 8 megabyte file. Let's back up a little bit and see if we can figure out how that happened. A while back, around January, when the Apple TV started supporting podcasting, I happened to look at my cover art on it at Macworld Expo, and it looked horrible. So I had my logo artist, Ryan Sakamoto from GraphicForce.net, make me a much higher resolution version. What I thought we had done was make a 600 by 600 DPI logo, but it turns out that all this time, I have been wasting your bandwidth by sending you a 6,000 by 6,000 DPI image. I cannot believe that this is the first time anyone noticed this. I did an experiment. Last week's show was 53 minutes long, and it was a 32 meg file. I swapped in the 188 kilobyte 600 DPI version instead of the 7.6 megabyte 6,000 DPI version, and the MP3 file size went from 32 meg down to 24.5 meg, just as it should have. I think we should all thank Mark Andre for saving us 7.5 megabytes per week for the next 20 years that you're going to be listening to me. Can you believe that? I told this story to Bart, and Bart said, "I want my bits back." I said I'd give him double his money back. How's that? You may have heard that this week the fine folks over at Codeweavers decided to give their software Crossover away for free for one day in honor of George W. Bush accidentally meeting one of the 6 challenges they set for him. I think it was getting gas under $14 a gallon or something like that. Anyway, the website is pretty funny and it's worth checking out. But the main point here is that Crossover was free for a day. Luckily, I found out about it the day before, thanks to Twitter, and since it was 11 p.m. where I am when I found out about it, 11 p.m. the day before, and they're evidently on East Coast time, it was already tomorrow where they were, so I got in early. I say I was lucky because their servers were totally overwhelmed the next day, and many people were never able to get in and take advantage of the free offer. Let's back up a little bit for those who haven't heard of Crossover. This is software that allows you to emulate Windows system calls on your Mac, allowing you to run Windows-only programs without buying Windows or running it on your Mac. I tested Crossover and reviewed it on a show back in September of 2006, and I tried running OpenOffice on it, and I tried it again in February of 2007. Back then, I tried loading a few unsupported applications, like I said, OpenOffice for Windows, which did work, by the way, and Firefox for Windows in 2007, which did not work. One issue here is that if you don't actually own any Windows-only applications, it's kind of hard to test this software. You pretty much have to go find some open-source stuff to test it. They have what they call officially supported packages, which means that if you own those applications, you can install them and they're fully tested. The odd thing to me is that in that list, they've gone to a lot of work to test out applications that actually have versions for OS X. So why would I want to run them in an emulated mode? They have Photoshop and Lotus Notes, both of which work on OS X. All of the Microsoft Office products, too, that do run on OS X, but not Microsoft Access, which does not run on the Mac, which would be really handy to have a version for the Mac. They do have Outlook and Visio that don't run on the Mac, and QuickBooks, which I'm pretty sure doesn't either. Windows Media Player 9 is in the list, and it might be handy, since it's pretty common to find sites that require it, but luckily fewer and fewer. Same thing with IE6. When you really need it, you really need it, so it might be good to have, but luckily most sites have moved over to the right side of the world on that issue. Well, Greg Taylor, who's in the chat room right now, says that he's been using it to run Visio 2003 for years, and he says it works great, really, really helps him out. So that's good to know. Well, I was hoping that in the 2 years since I started reviewing Crossover, there'd be a lot more supported applications, but that list looked pretty much the same from, 2 years ago. Perhaps this would be a good solution maybe for switchers who don't want to buy their software all over again, like let's say you bought Photoshop for Windows and you wanted to switch. Might be good if you could use it in this kind of emulation mode. Well, I did install IE6 and it ran beautifully, pretty much like last time. But again, I was surprised that Crossover didn't have an approved IE7 version. I guess we don't need IE7 the way we might occasionally need IE6, say if you run into a web developer who's still living in 1995. What I'd really like to see was Chrome, so I tried installing it, but it failed. Then I remembered that the Crossover people had sent me a link to the free Chromium Crossover for Mac, which does not require Crossover at all. It's available at a link I put in the show notes. I was able to go to Google and then Google/IG, but it drew the screen twice for some reason, which was a problem I complained about 2 years ago on IE6. Then I tried to go to podfeet.com and it crashed. Reopened just fine and very quickly, but it still crashed when I went to podfeet.com. I went over to surfbits.com and it worked fine, but then I clicked a link on to podfeet.com on Tim's site and it crashed again. Why would Chromium not like my site? Are they mad at me? I don't understand. It also didn't crash just one tab, which is what happens in real Chrome. It killed the whole beast. One application I really like at work is the open source text editor called Notepad++ from sourceforge.net that only runs under Windows. I use it to edit PHP code and WordPress theme files, and it does a great job of, color coding things to make sure you're not making mistakes, like forgetting to close a comment and thereby leaving the entire rest of your file as a comment. As you write your PHP commands, it's automatically changing the colors to know when your syntax is properly set up. Well, I went to the CodeWeavers website, and there I found listings of over 4,800 unsupported applications that people have tested. I found Notepad++ in there saying that it works. I downloaded it from SourceForge, installed it into what they call a bottle for Windows XP, and it worked immediately. I'm excited that I have this at my fingertips now because I just hadn't found anything quite like it that I liked as well on the Mac. Well, discovery of the unsupported applications really opens up my thoughts about what Crossover can do. In there, they rate the applications with gold, silver, bronze, and even honorable mention. With those ratings, they kind of tell you how well tested it is. Obviously, gold is really good and it totally works and all that kind of stuff. Honorable mention, I think that one's in the category of almost works, because they have doesn't work as an option as well. So one of the nice things is they show you applications people have already tried and they don't work. Anyway, if you've got a need for an application that only runs on Windows and you can't bring yourself to shell out hundreds of dollars to give to Microsoft to buy Windows, then you should try to give the 30-day trial a try. That's a lot of tries. Give the 30-day trial a try over at Crossover. It's only $40 now to buy. Used to be $60 when I first reviewed it. So go over to codeweavers.com and check it out for yourself. If you have a Honda or an Acura and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, do not let your car break down for the next week or so. You see, Honda Bob did a crazy wild thing. He's taking a vacation. He's off visiting his mom and his brother back in Louisiana right now. Isn't that sweet? He says she had a big old list of honeydews all ready for them when they got to her house. I think he and his brother must get along great, though, because they had it all done really, really quickly. Imagine being lucky enough to have a mechanic who loves his mother. Can you say that? I know, it's not an essential element in choosing your auto mechanic, but it does talk to character. Honda Bob is reliable, very hardworking, tells bad jokes, and drives to your house to fix your car so you don't have to be in the teeniest, tiniest bit inconvenienced. It's really the perfect service model from the end user's point of view. I can't believe no one has thought of this other than Honda Bob. I mean, why is there no Toyota Bob? Well, there isn't. If you'd like to have this kind of convenient in-home care for your Honda cars, just give them a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot them an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the show again where we do chit-chat across the pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartb.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm good, but cold. It's bloody freezing here.
Ah, well, we had a crisis. It sprinkled. It sprinkled yesterday. We almost had a puddle.
Wouldn't want to come over here. You'd have a constant crisis.
It was scary. It was frightening. We didn't know which car to drive because we fought over whose was going to get dirty. It was terrible. It was a nightmare.
If we look at rain as washing cars. But anyway.
All right. Well, we have an awfully full agenda today, so we probably should kick in. Let's start out with Security Lite, my favorite subject.
Yes. And it's the Mac's turn again this week after a little brief interlude into Windows land last week. Something which doesn't come as a surprise to me in the slightest, but seems to have the blogosphere all at Twitter, is that they have found malware for the Mac, yet another Trojan. In my opinion, I've been saying this stuff is doing the rounds for ages because it has been. It isn't actually news, but for some reason, this one seems to have caught the attention of the blogosphere, whereas the other ones didn't, which I can't understand. But now they're talking about end of the world and comparing Mac OS X to Windows 98 and all this other kind of rubbish. But
well,
the bottom line is,
we haven't had a lot of exploits. We've had vulnerabilities, but we haven't had a lot of exploits of those vulnerabilities, right?
Yeah, no, having said that, every vulnerability is a potential exploit.
Sure.
And Apple have been notoriously slow at patching some of them. Annoyingly so, as I've highlighted many, many times on this very segment.
Right. So what's the exploit of the week this time?
It's not even an exploit. This is a Trojan. So basically, the idea is you go to a website, they give you some still shots of some pornography, and they tell you there's this lovely free video over here. And then you click on the link and it says, oh, we're terribly sorry, but you don't seem to have the right codec to play this lovely free video. Well, look at all these lovely stills. Isn't it pretty? And then they say, click here, download this, install this. And what you're actually doing is installing malware. And I don't think you ever get to see your pornography. So you lose all around.
You don't even get the porn out of the deal. Wow. That's a really bad deal. You lose your credit cards and the porn.
What it does is the classic. It manipulates your DNS settings so that you don't go to your DNS server, you go to their DNS server, and they control where you go on the internet, even though you think you're going to PayPal, but you're actually going to wherever they send you. So it's a pretty nasty man-in-the-middle type attack. They can route all of your traffic through their servers, basically, by manipulating your DNS. This is awfully, awfully similar looking to the behavior I saw in the infected Macs we saw at work 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, no, I kind of scoffed. I didn't really believe you, but, well, I sort of believed you because you're Bart, but I thought, oh, come on, this doesn't happen to us.
Yeah, well, two machines last month, that's more than I've seen in my entire life. Two of them came together.
Oh, wow. And it was basically, you could see the DNS changing, like you had set it correctly and it would change it back?
Well, the symptoms we saw were, first of all, using the GUI, you couldn't change it. You could see the DNS, but it was grayed out.
Wow.
And when I went into the low-level Unix stuff to change it, it changed back.
Yikes, that does sound like it. Now, just to be fair, you could put this Trojan on non-porn sites. It could be, you know, kittens playing the piano website, right?
I mean, the one that was doing rounds last year that didn't put the whole web of Twitter, even though it was exactly as bad as this, is a poker game. And then there's another one that did the rounds a few weeks ago called Mac Fixer that is pretend antivirus. So it tells you your machine is infected and will fix it for you, and in the process infects it.
So that's a classic on the Windows side, right?
Yeah, these are all classic Windows tricks. games, codecs, and fake antivirus. They are the classic Windows malware tricks.
See, you know, I think the most brilliant is the codec thing, because how many times do you actually need a codec? Like 95% of the time you try to play something, oh, there's this codec you forgot to get, or you don't have Flash Player 9 or whatever. We're always downloading something to play video. So that's a brilliant exploit.
Well, and the reason is because I've installed one QuickTime plugin called Pyrian, which is basically, it's called the Swiss Army knife for video, and that's pretty much what it does. It gives you just about every plugin. One neat little package.
Ah, okay.
So I never actually download codecs. You should be highly suspicious of being asked to download a codec.
Right.
And you should probably do it yourself rather than taking any site's word for it. Downloading games, dangerous, and certainly never, ever, ever believe a website that tells you you're infected with malware and offers to help.
So,
you know, it's bad news every time.
Is that pretty much the basic message? If you're on a website and it tells you you need to do something, unless you're 100% sure you're on Microsoft's website at the time they say download Windows Media Player or whatever, take your own path to get there, basically, would be the right answer, right?
Yeah. You initiated, you go look for the stuff. Don't just take stuff from random sites that offer it to you.
That's a good hint in the email scams, too, is if it says something about, you know, your American Express card has an issue and you really are concerned, you want to make sure you're okay, well, type in, you know, AmericanExpress.com yourself into your browser and see what's going on over there.
Yeah, it's exactly the same sort of logic, yeah. Don't follow, go.
I actually made that mistake this week. There was I got an email about a PDF application to edit PDFs, and you know, I get a lot of those, and you know, PDF Pen is a great application, things like that. And I thought, oh, it's just one of those, and I clicked it, and I was like, oh, Al, geez, kind of a moron. I didn't even look at the link, and it was a scam phishing site. I didn't, you know, get caught by it, but I was like, oh, geez, you know better than that.
Yeah, if there had been a browser vulnerability at the time, that you could be nabbed.
Yep.
Just by visiting.
Yep. Could have definitely been caught. So
the big message from this, though, is that this particular bit of malware appears to be coming from a well-known Russian gang of mobsters who had until now been focusing their nefarious attempts at Windows and are now porting their techniques to the Mac. So the Mac has come to the attention of Russian gangsters, so we are in the firing line.
Oh, joy. So in the spirit of Security Light, our rule is it has to be something you can do something about, and the rule is
ever present vigilance, I'm afraid. There is no easy answer to this.
So, well, it is not downloading something because a website tells you to.
Yeah, but it's but there's no silver bullet for this kind of thing, because they are trying to trick you. So be suspicious of everything.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like we said last week, the days for being smug are over, but I didn't really think it would go quite this bad in 1 week.
Now, one thing I do want to make clear, you and I were talking about this offline, is that this is not a virus.
No.
It's a Trojan horse. So if you get infected, you don't infect somebody else.
Yeah, it's a virus is something that spreads itself. A Trojan is something that you install because it pretends to be something it's not. So it's you doing the installing. It's not using a vulnerability. It's not breaking in. It's simply, you know, pretending to be a gift from some website and is in actual fact full of nasty soldiers that are going to kill you at night.
Oh, good. Okay, well, but that is an important distinction. Not that we won't have a virus someday, but this is not a virus. So
That someday is not today.
Not that it won't be tomorrow. All right. Well,
by this time next week, we could be talking about that. But anyway,
This week we are going to stress the ever so slight Macintosh bias, because it's just a slight Macintosh bias on the show. We're going to talk about Windows 7.
Yeah, I was actually rather shocked, because I found myself kind of being impressed, not by all of it, but nonetheless, I did a fair bit of reading up on it, looking at the changes to the UI, and a lot of it looks awfully familiar, but there's some stuff in there that we don't have on the Mac that actually looks quite good.
Let's get the
poking fun at Microsoft bit out of the way.
Okay, wait, just a second. First, we should tell people what we're talking about is Windows 7 was shown at the developers conference for Microsoft, but it's not actually available until 2010. So this is sort of preview stuff, right?
Absolutely. It's the Professional Developers Conference or something. It's PDC, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, back to making fun of Microsoft.
Okay, so first we have some making fun to do, because really, I mean, they're selling this as a whole big, great new idea, but in actual fact, it's not a new idea. It's a very old idea. It's called the dock. So what they've done is the taskbar at the bottom, and I have always said I hate the taskbar. Because as soon as you open more than about six windows, you know, it starts off pretty good when you have three and you see a little icon and some text. And that works. But as you begin to scale, you end up with a little icon and some dots. And it's useless, utterly useless. And Microsoft have realized this, and they've replaced the little boxes with text and a teeny icon with just a big round icon.
Well, and they made it bigger. The dock itself is taller, so it has room for that.
Yeah, so they've made the start bar, or not the start bar, the task bar a little taller, and they've started putting in square big icons for each window instead of little ones.
Right, right.
And you can now rearrange these icons, and you can have these icons not go away when the application isn't running.
Right, it's so if you have a favorite application, you can drop it in there. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and you can set the order, and it will stick.
Yeah, exactly. It is the dock.
That. It's the dock, right?
Now, they've added a nice, what I think is actually a nice little optimization. So Windows used to show you each window rather than each program, but now that it's gone to the Microsoft dock, effectively, it's each program. So what about if you want to see individual windows? Well, if you hover over the icon, you get a little thumbnail of each of the windows that belong to that app, and you can click on the thumbnail to go to the appropriate app. That's nice.
That's sort of like the dock.
Well, the dock doesn't do that. If I have 10 terminal windows open and I hover over the terminal icon, I don't get thumbnails of the 10 terminal windows.
If you click on it, you do.
No, then I get the 10 terminal windows.
Right, that's what we just said, though. Like, if I click on the Skype icon,
these are small little thumbnails, so you can see all of your browser windows. They're just tiny little thumbnails that just pop up.
Right. Okay. So it's hover instead of click, though. That's the only difference.
Yeah, but you don't. When you click, you actually move to those to that app.
Not if you let go.
OS 10.
Not if you just let go. You don't.
What? I have my focus. Different dock to me.
I have my focus on Firefox right now, and I'm clicking on Skype, and I'm looking at the options, and then I let go. I just clicked it again, and it never switched to Skype. It stayed on Firefox.
Okay, no, that's brought up a little pop-up menu.
Right, that shows the three. The three windows.
I'm talking about a little icon, a little actual thumbnails of the window, so you can actually see what they are.
Okay, it's not pretty. Gotcha.
Okay, yeah, but no, it's different because they've also added this context menu, which is exactly the menu you've just described.
You're talking about the
which they're calling something else.
Jumpstart, but that's something different altogether. That's to open other things that you've had open before. This is just showing what I have open right now.
Okay, it's okay. In this one, Microsoft are ahead of the game because we do not have the ability to see little thumbnails of our windows.
Right, gotcha.
So they're ahead of us on that one.
Okay,
it's a nice little touch. It's a logical addition. Now, where things begin to go downhill and we get back into typical Microsoft territory, is the fact that sitting over on the left hand side is the start menu, which is the cluttered nightmare it ever was.
Well, they've cleaned it up some.
I couldn't see any sign of any cleaning. It looked every bit as cluttered as ever.
Hmm.
To me now, and it does not match the nice, clean, new, Microsoft dock. It's like, we've gone halfway, but, oh, God, we're scared of going any further. So here's your crappy old start menu. Ta-da!
Now, I'm excited about the notification area, which is the part over on the right-hand side that's usually full of crap. I mean, it's just full of stuff, all kinds of weird little icons of things running, and the icons are about, 3x3 pixels, so you can't tell what they are. And if you hover over them, it shows you what they are, but then you can't see some of them, so you push that little arrow to see more of them. And then when you're hovering over those, it closes that arrow back up on you before you can figure out which app is which. I hate that!
Well, the little arrow is a new thing in the later versions of XP and Vista. I mean, that was an optimization to try to deal with the absolute explosion of those annoying little menu icons. On the Mac, they tend to be optional in every program that creates them. So you simply, you either do or don't enable the little menu bar icon. Whereas on Windows, you don't have any control over that, and the programs just barf them out. So Microsoft have taken the bull by the horns and said, okay, the app isn't giving you a choice, so we're going to give you the choice. And apps basically make these icons available now, but they don't show up unless you ask Windows to show them.
Yeah, I like that the default
you're getting
is off.
Control.
Yeah.
Hmm?
The default is that they don't show. You have to ask for them to show. So that'll be kind of nice because you can just narrow it down to the ones you want to see. The downside is that was an indicator of how much slop was running that maybe you didn't even intend to have run. Because a lot of Windows applications, you install them and they say, hey, you know what? We're going to start up every time you start up your computer for you. And they don't ask. So you're not going to know anymore because they're all hidden from you. So that a little bit of a downside, but I think that's still a better choice.
Absolutely. It had gotten completely out of hand, so this is a good call by Microsoft. While we're praising Microsoft, they've also added two new features that I think are fantastic, they provide the same functionality as Exposé, but do so differently, which is great to see, because Microsoft have been known to start their photocopiers, as Apple would say. So I'm glad to see them attack the same problems that I think are addressed well by Exposé, but they're addressing them differently, and I think they've done it quite cool. So the first feature is called peeking, where basically all of your windows become completely transparent apart from the one you're trying to peek at. And so you can basically see through everything to what you want without rearranging any of your windows. Which is somewhat equivalent to the F10 in Exposé, because when you hit it again, everything goes back to the way it was. But it achieves it in a different way. And it looks pretty cool. And then the other one, which is a way of dealing with your windows, is, I think, genius. So you pick up a window and you move it to the top of the screen. When you bounce the mouse off the top of the screen with the window becomes full screen.
That's pretty cool.
You take the window and you drag it down again, and it goes back to where it was.
That's very cool. I like that.
Yeah, but they've gone further. If you drag it down to the bottom of the screen, you minimize it.
Nice.
So if you want to minimize something, you pick it up and you drag it to the bottom, and it goes zoop, and it goes into the little dock. And the even cooler one, because this is something you actually do quite often, you often want to compare two things. And to do so, what you really want is the two windows that take up half the screen each.
Right.
So you pick up a window, you drag it to the right edge of the screen, it becomes half the size of the screen and docks itself to the right of the screen. You pick up your other window, you do the same on the left, and it does the same, so you end up with two perfect halves. You drag them away and they go back to the way they were.
I love that. That should be really fun. But one of the things that bugs me in a lot of Windows applications, unlike the Mac applications, is you can't actually see the window separately. So if you're in Excel and you open two windows, two spreadsheets, they're still in the same window. They aren't separate. So you still have to use the built-in stuff in Excel to say, yeah, I want to tile it side by side. I hate that. I would love to have something like that work for Excel.
Are Microsoft not heading more towards the Mac model on that? I haven't used the very latest versions of Office.
I should check that.
I don't use Office.
I don't either. At home, anyway. But at work, I actually have Office 2007. I should check that because I'm still complaining about it. And it's the older Office that I'm talking about. Well, one of the Exposé-like things I'm excited about is now in the very bottom right-hand corner, there's a little tiny little block that you click and basically you see your desktop. And then you click
very
it again
handy.
And everything comes back. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they've also, which this has become more important because they've gotten rid of the sidebar that Vista had where all your gadgets lived.
Right.
And the gadgets now live on your desktop. And they got rid of that for the simple reason that with all these ultra-mobile PCs and stuff, screen real estate is at a premium. And the concept of losing a massive chunk of it to that silly sidebar, it was silly. And Microsoft realized this. So they've put the gadgets onto your desktop so it becomes even more important to get a look at your desktop.
That's actually
part of that peeking that I was talking about. So that's peeking at the desktop.
Right. Now, I want to say two things. The first thing I was going to say about that little expose-like thing to let you see the desktop, I forget what they call it.
Peeking.
Okay.
P-E-E-K.
Oh, okay. That's an awful long ways to travel, to go all the way down to the bottom right-hand corner. I am loving the four-finger touch on the new MacBook Pros, where I can just simply drag straight up with four fingers, and I see my desktop straight back down, and I'm done. So just in and out.
Yeah.
To drag all the way to the bottom right-hand corner. I hope there's like a keystroke or something for that would be nice.
We don't know whether we're going to set up keystrokes. That will be very handy.
Yeah. I'm sure some third-party developer will just make one, so that'd be cool. Back to them respecting screen real estate, though. You know what? They better make some huge changes in things like IE7, IE8. IE8, I am not kidding you, it is more than an inch of vertical desk space they take for the top part of the window. Now, if you're on a laptop, it's not side to side that you got issues with. They're over there fixing that sidebar. I got a lot of width. What I don't have is height. I mean, I put some screen snapshots in the show notes a while back where I took Chrome, Firefox, and then IE8. And I mean, it's comical how much space is just wasted. And there's no value in it either. That's not like there's icons there. There's not pull down menus. There's no file menu. There's nothing there. It's just empty space.
Yeah. The fact that they got rid of all the useful stuff and didn't give you the space back. It's like, come on, you're halfway there, but you missed the important
thing. Right. I would like the stuff back, too, actually, in a small interface. I mean, it's possible.
If you're going to take away the stuff, at least save some space with it.
And there's no hope for the future, the immediate future, because IE8 is worse than IE7. But luckily, IE8 is so buggy, I got rid of it.
Okay. Well, that's not good either.
All right, so what else?
The other thing I want to mention, well, do you want to bring up something else? Or
I had one more in there, a couple more in there. I read that they're going to have a lot more support for multi-touch, but it looks like they're really focusing on multi-touch on the screen. I do not
see,
want
this
to be touching my monitor. Oh, okay, go ahead.
Because I think this is stupid.
Yeah.
And I think you're about to make exact the same point, aren't you?
Right. Go ahead.
Well, after you. It's your show.
Well, okay, so all the displays on the Mac end are going glossy and fingerprints on the screen. I don't let anybody touch my screen ever, 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 ever. Why would I want to touch my screen? Not to mention, think of the repetitive stress injuries of having your arm out at full length touching your screen. That's ridiculous.
It's not practical.
Right.
Unless we move to having our monitors flat on our desks, which isn't practical for all sorts of other reasons.
Right.
Apple have the right idea with doing it in the trackpad, and Microsoft haven't copped onto that.
It's very sexy,
you know, with their Surface, which is flat and tabley. It's very sexy to do it on the actual screen. But I think they've missed the point.
Yeah. I don't think there's... No.
Yeah, exactly. That sums it up, really.
Oh, you hush. Now, one thing I was intrigued by was that so Vista did a lot of huge architectural changes under the hood, and then they put a really bad interface on top of it. This Windows 7 is actually no architectural changes. It's all the GUI, and I think that's what normal people really care about. I mean, okay, good, make it safe and blah blah blah, but I want it to look pretty, I want it to interact well with me, I want it to be easy to use. And they so missed the boat on Vista. This is actually the OS everybody was really waiting for, I think. Normal people.
Now, you say there's no changes under the hood. And architecturally, I guess there's not a big change, because they're saying that anything that works on Vista will work on Windows 7.
Right.
So if your driver, you know, if your printer works now, your printer will still work when you upgrade, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But they are actually doing stuff under the hood, because there was a separate presentation. Now, I unfortunately don't have the link, because one of the guys in work was talking about it, and he couldn't remember the exact link. But actually, it was Peter. But one of the guys who's head of the project did a demo of Windows 7 running on an EEE PC.
Mm.
Now, could you imagine trying to get Vista to do that?
Not exactly.
And it was running with a footprint of disk space of 500 megs.
Wow. So they're becoming an ultra mobile version of it, maybe?
It's possible that that's going to be a very cut-down version, but it seemed fully functional when he did the demo. So they seem to be optimizing. So they seem to be doing what Snow Leopard is doing.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That's exciting.
It's very cool. That actually interests me more, because my biggest gripe with Vista really is its bloatware. I mean, it's unbelievable bloatware. Needing a minimum of 2 gigs of RAM to run it, you know, passably, and 4 gigs of RAM to run it well is just absolute insanity. I mean, Aero is pretty, Aero is very nice, but come on, you know, so much graphics memory, so much hardware needed. My little Mac Mini G4 does cool and shiny, and it's only got a gig of RAM, and it's old, and, you know, it has 32 megs of graphics memory. So if they can optimize it, they're on to a winner, because that really annoyed me more than anything else about Vista.
Well, that could increase sales too, right? If you could put it on older machines.
Yeah.
Then you'll actually buy it on top of not just buying a new machine, because I don't think pretty much more than about 6 or 8 people have probably bought it separate from buying a new machine.
Well, you have the other issue. You have the people who bought machines that were labeled as Vista capable, which were so not Vista capable.
I think they're actually sorry about that. I think they'd like us to stop yelling at them, because I think they get that one.
But no, I have a friend, and he positively hates Vista because he bought a cheap laptop and it came with Vista. And it's not able to run Vista.
Yeah. No, but I mean, Microsoft, I think, may even have formally apologized for that one. Because I think, Ballmer or Gates, I forget which one, caught on to it and was like, you've got to be kidding me. We said those were Vista capable, so that's changed.
It'd be nice, though, if they ran Windows 7 well and that people could actually upgrade and go to a higher version of Windows and get better performance.
That would be very...
You know that little luxury we Mac users have had for years?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have one thing that I certainly hope they do something about, and I didn't see anything encouraging about this specifically, but maybe it's just because I don't know how to work in Windows very well, but in Windows Vista, when you just a default window opens, the default column view shows you things like how many stars have you given it? You know, things that you would do with photos or with audio, but not, I mean, you know, I don't have a favorite Excel spreadsheet that I give it five stars, you know? I want to see the date it was created, and I want to see the file type and the size. Those are things that are really important to me. Maybe modified date, but that's not the default. The default's how many stars, you know?
That's a bit silly.
I have yet to figure out how to consistently change that across the board in all my windows. I keep asking people, and they'll fix it for one window, but it'll all open another one. And the other thing is, when you do I really hope these options they have that they were showing in the how to open things, you know, you had all these great little options. I hope they do it in the save as and in the open dialog boxes, because I have to drill down every single time to a file that I've opened 46 times in the last 2 hours, you know. But if I open Excel first and then I say I want to open that file, none of those options are there. I have to drill down every time, and it drives me crazy. And I think it's responsible for carpal tunnel syndrome in its entirety right there.
Quite probably.
So let's see. We did want to end on mocking. We want to bracket both ends. Mock at, Microsoft at the beginning and the end, and the nice part was in the middle. Have you seen what they're doing with the homemade I'm a PC commercials?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
But what I have heard, this was a big deal that came up in the chat room on IMP last night. They put one of those booths outside the Apple store in Birmingham.
Booths? What booths?
It's a little booth where you can go in and record your I'm a PC, and they stuck it in front of the Apple store.
Oh, that's really funny, because they're just going to get people who like Apple making fun of Microsoft with that.
I know.
So what I believe has happened, and I'm only seeing the symptom here, is that they're letting people make their own I'm a PC commercial, and or where they say I'm a PC and they say something about themselves. But the ones they chose that were evidently good enough to put on national TV were things like this guy, and I swear I'm not making this up. He goes, I'm a PC and I like pancakes.
Oh, God.
I felt so bad for Microsoft. There were like four in a row in one commercial, and three of the four were as bad as that.
Oh, dear. This brings up a little rant of mine. Well, sort of semi-rant. They've missed the point.
Yeah.
The PC and the Mac are not caricatures of PC users and Mac users. They're anthropomorphized computers.
Right. You're right. They totally did miss it.
They completely missed the point.
I guess they're trying to make it sound cool, but or for regular people or something. But it was just sad. I just like, you guys, just fire these advertising people right now. Fire them.
The first clue should have been that they hired Seinfeld.
Well, and then, of course, stop Seinfeld after $10 million. And it's just sad. They should just stop. Hush.
let's
clean our palate with something really exciting out of Ireland.
Yeah, this is cool. Right now, as it happens, I know both of these guys, which makes it even cooler for me. But Ireland is not a big place. It doesn't have a massive astronomical heritage because we have this slight issue called clouds and rain and weather in general. So we don't really see the sky very often. However, that hasn't stopped people from trying, and two amateur astronomers from all within about 20-mile radius of me have both discovered asteroids this month. Well, last month, because we're now into November.
Wow, that's so cool.
This is pretty cool, because there were two guys discovered one asteroid each in October 2008. That brings the grand total ever in the history of time to three. And the first one was in 18-something.
Wow.
It was, in fact, I have the date here, 1848.
That is so cool. I mean, just they found asteroids. That's very cool.
Now, these guys they're not professional astronomers. They're amateur astronomers. It's just something they do in the evening. Now, they're both very serious about it. And they have spent years getting to this stage. So they have actually quite modest equipment, really. But they have it tuned to absolute perfection, and they have perfected using it to the point where they can do really good science with it. And they started off because it's actually quite important work. So they would look up for what asteroids that are known about should be visible, and they would confirm their orbits and then send the information to the Minor Planet Center, which allows them to tweak the orbits of these asteroids. It's actually really important work, because we need to know as carefully as possible where all the asteroids are going so we know when one's about to twat us. So this is actually very important work, and it's pretty much all done by amateurs. So they started off doing that, and you know, it was a big deal when they got accepted into that program, because you actually have to do sort of a test to prove that you're good enough. And it's pretty grueling, and they want you to track, I think it's 3 asteroids for 2 consecutive nights, and it has to be 2 consecutive nights. So in Ireland, you're straight off fighting the weather, and it took the guys a while to get certified. And it was a really big deal in the Irish astronomical community when the 2 guys got certified. Wow. And actually, 3 guys got certified. It wasn't just the 2 of them. It was 3 in total. But then recently, the guys decided that they would go looking for asteroids in parts of the sky that we know haven't been surveyed very well by professionals. So sort of little black holes in our knowledge. And they figured that, you know, they'd have slightly higher chances if they looked where other people hadn't looked. And to give you a direct quote from one of the guys, it's, "We thought we'd stack the odds in our favor, but we did not think that we'd hit the proverbial jackpot so soon. We thought it would take years."
Wow.
So
hey,
within a month.
Give their names.
Okay, this is funny, because apparently in order to be an astronomer in Ireland, you have to be called Dave. So it's Dave McDonald and Dave Grennan.
Excellent, excellent. Now, you've also put links in the show notes to a couple of web pages, one of which has a little animation showing this teeny tiny little dot going by on screen.
Yeah, and that's to give you somebody. The first one was Dave McDonald, and his asteroid was insanely dim. It was magnitude 19.9. Now, astronomers measure magnitude on a logarithmic scale, so it's like the Richter scale. So you don't, it doesn't go up linearly, it goes up exponentially. Mm-hmm. And so 0 is the brightest star in the sky, 6 is the dimmest star you can see with your eyes. And so this went up to almost 20.
Wow.
And even a decade ago, you would have been laughed at if you would say that an amateur with an 8-inch telescope would get to magnitude 20. It's all down to the fact, it's actually digital camera technology. CCD cameras have gotten so sensitive that even on modest amateur equipment, you can see down to these ridiculous depths. So they can see very dim, and then they run this thing. They take images consecutively, and they see what moves and doesn't move. Anything that moves against the stars is something else. Asteroid, comet, or satellite, basically. And then they need to make sure it's not one that's been discovered before. But when you look at how dim that little dot is, it's quite staggering. Dave's one is about 2 kilometers across and is sitting in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Actually, the book called Dave, so Dave McDonald's one. And then the second one is even bigger. It's about, I think, hang on, where does it say here? I think it said 3 to 6 kilometers across, which is insanely big. And as Dave Grennan says, "I'm amazed that something so big could be missed." So he actually picked up a pretty impressive one.
That's only 3 miles across. That's a big 3.5 miles across.
Oh, yeah.
That's big, huh?
Those things come in hundreds of kilometers per second. Something that big would knock out the entirety of America.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, that's a continent killer.
Yikes. Okay, so these aren't coming at us or anything, though, right?
They're not coming at us. They're both sitting happily in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. No way are they coming anywhere near us.
Cool. That's even better.
Yeah, and they get to name them. So at the moment, they have temporary designations. So Dave McDonald's one is the really, really sexy name of 2008 TM9. And Dave Grennan's is 2000 and... where has it gone? 2008... US3.
Yeah, I do hope they come up with sexier names than that.
But no, they get to propose a name to the International Astronomical Union, who then approve it or not. So they get to call it after someone, and they have to say who they're calling it after.
Oh. Okay.
Actually, it's funny because Dave Grennan, the first guy to discover, Dave McDonald, oh, so many Daves, actually has an asteroid named after him already for some of the work he did. He was actually voted the Irish Amateur Astronomer of the Year by the Irish Federation of Astronomical Societies last year. And he made big headlines when he made the confirmation observation of a supernova. So to become an official supernova, someone has to discover it and someone has to verify it. So he did the verification, which was a first for Ireland as well.
Wow.
So these guys are really, really shaking up astronomy in Ireland.
That's exciting.
To know both of them, and they're both dead sound guys, and I'm really chuffed for them. So congratulations to both of them.
Yeah, do send along our current congratulations as well. That's very, very cool. I know it didn't technically fit maybe the plot line of the show, but that's one of the reasons I named it vaguely, so we can talk about anything technical we want. It's technical.
Absolutely. These guys use a lot of computer equipment.
There you go. Well, thanks for telling us about that. That's very cool. I'm really excited about that. Anything like that's very fun to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, the whole Irish astronomical community is just completely a Twitter about this. It's fantastic.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bart. I think this was a really fun show.
Absolutely. I think we're business as usual next week, I think, are we?
I believe so.
Excellent. Until then, happy computing.
Well, it looks like that's going to close up the show for this week. Remember that I love to get your emails. I don't even call if you write to me and tell me I'm stupid and that I've been making the file size of the MP3 25% bigger than it should have been for the last 10 months. 8 months? 10 months. Anyway, shoot your emails off to nosilicast@gmail.com. And if you feel like recording a review, try to keep it in the 3 to 5 minute range. That seems to be kind of the sweet spot for people. As always, make sure that you follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet and join in the fun over at the chat room in at ustream.tv/nosilicast at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sunday nights. And yes, the United States is back in sync with the rest of the world, so that's the actual time. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.